from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the middle of a hard century, singer Edith Piaf captured the hearts of the French.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses
They called her the Little Sparrow. She sang of hardship, longing, and the beautiful life, La Vie en Rose. Edith Piaf had a rags-to-riches story, born into poverty, raised in a brothel, and catapulted to fame through song and a heartbreakingly forceful voice. She lived hard through war and tumult, addicted to morphine and alcohol, and was dead at 47 in 1963. But that voice and sound live on. This hour on Point, we're talking about the life and music of Edith Piaf in the new movie out of France, La Vie en Rose. You can join the conversation. Is this your song, your singer, your Paris? Do you get lost in the music of Edith Piaf? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Olivier Dahan. He's the writer and director of the new movie La Vie en Rose called La Môme in France. The movie was released to much praise in February at the Berlin Film Festival. On June 8th, the film opens in America. Olivier Dahan, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hello.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Jean-Max Guy. He's professor of French civilization and culture at Georgetown University, co-editor of Memories for the 21st Century, Cultural Experiments in 20th Century France. Jean-Max Guy, thank you very much for being here as well.
Hello, Tom.
Wonderful to have you both, and wonderful to have a chance to have this music in our ear. Olivier Dahan, how do the French see Edith Piaf today? Is she like an antique, a relic from a different time? Is she still popular? What's been the reaction to your film and bringing her life to the screen?
She's like an icon in France, actually. And she's still very, very popular. Without talking about the movie, just her and the songs. She's still on the radio and she's still on air, you know.
She's still on air, and what about the turnout for the film? Are French people turning out in big numbers to look back on this live?
The movie in France have been a huge success. I mean, a lot of people, and a very big part of this audience was very young. So for her, it was pretty surprising. I know.
Yeah, a young audience turning out. Jean-Max, you, I think you actually saw Edith Piaf perform when you were a very young man, or that is, a boy. Take us back. When was it, and how, and what did you see?
Well, that must have been in the beginning of the 60s, and I remember that year my parents decided not to go to a New Year's Eve party, and instead to take me as a 10-year-old boy in Marseille to see Edith Piaf. And so that was a thrill, not only because I would go out with my parents, but I would see someone from Paris in the theater who would sing. At that time, she was singing with her husband, Jacques Pils, who was what we call in French the American star. The American star is the person who ends the part one of the show.
Right.
And in fact, he was really his American star. He was really Mr. Piaf. And it was really very thrilling for me, but you could feel the fact that their marriage was based on the fact that she was the star and he was the second banana, in a way.
And sitting there as a boy watching Edith Piaf, what did she stand for to you? Or when you look back, what was it on the stage when Edith Piaf was on the stage?
Well, on the stage, it was very fascinating because, remember, this is seen through a 10-year-old eyes, what I saw was a very tiny person on the stage dressed in a very simple way. And the only thing you could see on the stage was the spot all around her. And sometimes the spot will only go and focus on her face or just on the hand. It will be very different from what you would have seen elsewhere, where the singer will be there. Usually the women will wear a long dress. here she was. You will be really fascinated by just the face and the hands, and she would play that beautifully, of course, and she will sing beautifully. She will sing beautifully as well.
That remarkable voice. Let's get it in our ear. Here, going way back, is Edith Piaf, 1936. This would be just after she began her more public and recording period of singing. This is Mon Légionnaire from 1936.
Il avait de grands yeux très clairs où parfois passaient des éclairs comme au ciel passent des orages. Il avait plein de tatouages que j'ai jamais très bien compris. Son coup portait pas vu, pas pris. Sur son cœur on lisait personne, sur son bras droit un mot résonne. Je sais pas son nom, je ne sais rien de lui. Il m'a aimé toute la nuit.
It was a century of soldiers and war, and there she's singing about her legionnaire. Olivier Dahan, the life story of this woman, it sounds almost like a myth or like a made-up story. Remind us where she came from, just how hard her girlhood was.
Oh, it was pretty... it was pretty hard because her mother was actually a street singer. Her father was like also a street artist.
A contortionist, an acrobatic contortionist,
yeah,
from the circus.
Yeah. But in the street, without any circus, just
the
street. So it was quite hard. And they were both alcoholic. So, but by chance, they have abandoned Edith.
Abandoned her, and then ultimately her father taking her to his mother's, her grandmother's home.
Yeah, but later.
Yeah.
And so she was a lonely child, certainly.
She spent much of her girlhood in her grandmother's bordello.
Yeah.
You depict this vividly in the film. Mm-hmm. At one point, the doctor comes. She's sick, and the doctor says, "Whose child is this?" And her grandmother, who runs the bordello, says, "Nobody's."
Yeah, but for me, this part of a life, it's maybe some of the most happy part. I mean, because she was in the bordel, but she was surrounded by women and surrounded by love for this little part of a life, you know.
There's a piece in the film, I don't know if it's fact or part of her myth, that she loses her sight, goes blind for some period of time.
No, it was true, it's true.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then is taken to the shrine of St. Teresa and prays for sight, and miraculously back it comes.
Yeah, but that's one. I mean, she was a believer, and they were all believers, but actually it was just medicine.
That brought it back. But it seemed like a miracle. Jean-Max Q, there's so much in this life that has this feeling of tragedy that turns into beauty. Here she was, 4'8" tall, a tiny little singer, raised, born on the poor side of Paris, raised in very tough circumstances. That sense of the tragic, the lonely, stays with her all her life in her song, doesn't it?
Yes, and in fact, when you were talking about childhood, it's interesting because you feel, and the movies shows that very, very well, this sort of Zola sort of neighborhood where people are drunks, people are prostitutes, people are living the way they can, in trash, more or less. And even in the bordello, you have this sort of Maupassant feeling where you have the old bordello in a Maupassant story going for the first communion of a niece. There, the old bordello went into a novena to have Edith Piaf, Edith, the little girl, saved by Saint Teresa. Mm. It's almost like in a movie. But this went on all her life, the idea that she would have to pick up herself and, in a way, keep going on. And this is, I think, part of the attraction for the audience, of someone who is getting all the hard blows from life and is trying to make it, or maybe won't make it. You are observing here a character in the song, which is in a way the reflection of the character of the singer. Very pathetic.
Not a sort of always glossy, a perfectly put together singer that we've become used to in pop culture today by any means. I mean, she showed her weakness even on the stage,
mm-hmm.
at the same time as her strength. What do you think she stands for in French culture, Jean-Max?
Well, I think that in a way she arrived at the time when people were used to this type of what we call in French the realistic song. I mean, there is a tradition in the French musical to have what we call the realist singer. And you recognize them because they are always doing the same thing. They are talking about prostitutes, sailors, carnival, sort of fairy dust of life, and hard blows, and drunks. And they sing usually rolling their R's with the uvula.
we hear that with vigor, and we'll hear more of it. Jean-Max Guy, Olivier Dahan, please stand by. We're talking about the life and music of Edith Piaf. Here's Rien de Rien. I'm Tom Astrick. We've got much more to come. This is On Point.
J'aimerais que ça se passe, que ça se passe, ne serait-ce que pour moi. Comme ça, je verrai ce qui se passe, et je pourrais dire que ça se passe pas. Rien de rien. Je me demande pourquoi rien. Il ne se passe jamais rien.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the life and music of Edith Piaf, the iconic French singer. The story is told in the new movie, La Vie en Rose.
Vous asseoir à ma table, il fait si froid dehors. Ici c'est confortable, laissez-vous faire, Milord. Et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur. Et vos pieds sur une chaise, je vous connais.
There she is, tongue in full trill in 1959, Milord. We're joined today by Olivier Dahan. He's director of the new film La Vie en Rose. It tells the story of her life and what drove this famous French singer, and also by Jean-Max Guy. He's professor of French civilization and culture at Georgetown University in Washington. You can join us. Are you a fan of Piaf? Can we see her as the Billie Holiday, the Judy Garland, the Janis Joplin of France? And what's the deep theme that comes through Edith Piaf's song? Is it tragedy, endurance, defiance, love? How did you get turned on to Edith Piaf? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Olivier Dahan, I wish you'd give us a sense of how she moved from this poor waif growing up in her grandmother's bordello into the world of song.
She's been singing in the street for a long time. I mean, between something, there is not so much information about her between the age of maybe something like 12 and 15 years old. Mm-hmm. She was living at this time at 15 years old alone in Paris in Belleville with a friend of her, Simone. And
Belleville, very poor part of town. You show her at some point, maybe early in that period, with her father in the street. He's doing his act, and as you imagine it for the film, when he's finished his contortion, the crowd says, "You know, what else have you got? What about the girl? She's holding the hat for the queens. Can she sing?" And she breaks out in the Marseillaise.
Yeah, but that was, she was 10 years old at this time, something like this. But after that, she really was in Paris without father, without anybody of her family, just a friend, a very good friend of her. And they were together, living together in a little, very tiny apartment. And she really started to sing in the street at this time, I mean, in the street of Paris. And she would be like this singing in the street of Paris for a couple of years, since a guy, I mean, a club owner named Louis Le Play really find her in the street.
He's played by Gérard Depardieu in the film. I've got a short clip here from Olivier Dahan's film La Vie en Rose. Here's Edith Piaf, played by Marion Cotillard, getting her start, singing on the street corners of Paris, and later in this sing, she is discovered.
Merci, madame. Le cœur joyeux, comme des moineaux. L'hiver viendra et mon seul bien, madame. Ce pauvre corps qui, je le sens bien, déjà se lasse.
Marion Cotillard playing Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose. We spoke with her yesterday for a few minutes about what it was like to play this iconic French singer on film. Here she is explaining to us at On Point what she and audiences might learn about Edith Piaf from watching the movie La Vie en Rose.
At her time, she shared all her life with the audience. When she was ill, when she was in love, when she had a car crashed, she shared all this with the audience. But now, we just don't know anymore her life. So I really think that you can discover the whole life and most of this, the powerful woman she was, and. And I think, you discover a woman who shared everything.
Edith Piaf, a woman who shared everything on the stage. There says French actress Marion Cotillard, who plays Piaf quite remarkably in the new film La Vie en Rose. Jean-Max Guy, you've seen the film. What do you make of this young French actress's performance of Edith Piaf?
I think it's a fantastic performance. Not only she acts beautifully and can move the audience. I saw people crying during the movie. But she's really embodying, thanks to makeup and the dresses and everything, the different part of her life. You will see her beaming with the long hair, and then you will see her at the end of her life almost bald and looking dejected in a way. This is fantastic to see the transformation through that actress of, let's say, 30 years of the life of Edith Piaf. She is fantastic.
Yeah, quite an extraordinary transformation in conveying both the strength of the voice that came out of that little body, but also its vulnerability. I want to welcome one more voice into our conversation. Joining us from Leeds, England, is David Loosely, professor of contemporary French culture at the University of Leeds, author of Popular Music in Contemporary France. David Loosely, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you.
We're trying to capture what it was about Edith Piaf that so captured France and then much of the world in the middle of the 20th century. How do you put your finger on it?
Well, I think you have to answer that in two stages, how she captured France and then how she captured the rest of the world. I think she captured France really quite early on in her career, which, as you said earlier, starts around 1936-37, by giving a picture of a France which, of course, today has now gone. I mean, it was a colonial France for a start. Mm. And some of her early songs, I think you played one near the beginning, some of her early songs are about, you know, the French Foreign Legion, yeah. In all the exoticism of them being in the desert, being strong, manly types. And I think that's probably where the Piaf myth, which is not a word we've quite used yet, but I think it's true to say that she is a myth, and I think that starts in France. There also it starts because she has a nice reassuring sense of gender relationships. You know, men are men and women are women,
yes.
And the men are always square-shouldered and blonde and like the legionnaire that is in the song you mentioned you played earlier, mm-hmm. where as she says in the song, he's good-looking, he's slim, and he smells of hot sand. So
there's a man.
To do with it.
There's a man. And then the myth, but we're hearing so much and learning about her life. I mean, her life itself had a kind of mythological character to it. What's the myth that rises above the facts of her life, David?
Well, I think some of that myth is actually self-created. I think one of the things that's striking about her, and really interesting when you look back at her life with 40 years distance since her death, is the way that she built up that myth herself. you know, of you've talked about it already, the street kid, mm-hmm. brought up in a brothel, hard life, drinking from an early age, oppressed by male relationships in one form or another. And I think round about the wartime, probably actually from the time that she started performing in New York, which was 1947, I think she becomes aware of that. There is a certain kind of self-awareness that you can feel creeping in the song, into the songs and into her whole persona by the mid-1940s. So I think she does that, and she turns herself into the story of her own life. None of the things that she bases that on are necessarily untrue, although, you know, they're twisted. She gives them a little twist, like, for example, you were mentioning about her going blind. And, of course, the myth is that she went blind. All the prostitutes from the bordello trailed over to Lisieux to pray to Saint Teresa so that her sight would be recovered. And it was recovered. She recovered her sight, you know, shortly afterwards. Well, of course, from that point on, there's this big religious myth about her. But in fact, the complaint that she had, which was a form of conjunctivitis, in fact, would have cured itself anyway. It was only a temporary blindness.
Ah, but it makes for a great story. Let's hear
it a great story. That's right.
A great story for a great singer. Let's hear a little bit of her voice, and this is from Olivier Dehaene's film La Vie en Rose. Here is the voice of Edith Piaf herself speaking in English in front of her song Padam Padam.
This melody you will hear follows me everywhere I go. I hear it when I am sad, and especially when I am glad. It seems to mock me for my past sins. It taunts me, and it is driving me crazy. Padam. Cet air qui m'obsède jour et nuit. Cet air n'est pas né d'aujourd'hui. Il vient d'aussi loin que je viens, traîné par 100 000 musiciens. Un jour, cet air me rend.
Edith Piaf, 1951, with Padam, Padam. It mocks me, it taunts me, she says. Let's take a few of our callers. Somebody want to join. Claire's calling from Fairfax, Vermont. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You were asking for people who remembered when they met Piaf, as it were.
Yes.
And it was one of the grand moments in my life, so grand that everything around that moment I have remembered with incredible clarity.
Paint the picture for us, Claire. Where, when, what?
I'm 63 now. Mm. I was 21 at the time. It was the spring of 1965 in Hamilton, Ontario. And a woman I'd met at the university there, McMaster, had invited me for tea. And I walked into her apartment, and it was a beautiful, green, sunlit day.
Yeah.
And this record was on the record player. And the person who invited me, Una Wilms, disappeared into the kitchen. She was preparing tea.
Yeah.
And so I was left alone.
Edith Piaf.
With Edith Piaf, whom I didn't know. I didn't understand a word that was being sung, but I got chills to my spine.
And what did it conjure in you? What feeling? What emotion? What response?
Humanity, strength, love.
Yeah.
It was incredibly instantaneous, and I was mesmerized. And Una came back into the room, and she said, "Oh, do you like Piaf?" And I thought, "Aha, that's the name." And it wasn't surprising that it should be so strange to my ears.
Yeah.
But I just can't express how much that moment has meant to me, because we, as humans, have so few of those.
Yes, and she made moments like that for so many. Claire, thanks for that. Let me get another call from Thierry in Arlington, Massachusetts. Thierry, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
I'm calling you because Edith Piaf for me is something that is very profound. I am French, and I grew up listening to Edith Piaf. I'm 42 years old,
mm-hmm.
and my mother played it all the time. And there isn't one month that goes by to this day that I don't listen to one of her songs, or even interpretation from Serge Gainsbourg's Légionnaire, for instance. And to me, Piaf is a umbilical cord to France's culture and the depth of Paris. the if you want to say, the intimacy level is so profound. And I have an 8-year-old today to whom I sing La Vie en Rose frequently. She knows the words. She goes to the French school in Boston. And it's a to see that the movie is coming out in the United States and that the tradition keeps on going. And although my mother has met Edith Piaf, I've never have. The fact that I am here, I consider listening to Edith Piaf one of the most intimate connection to France.
Intimate and umbilical cord. But did she sound old-fashioned to you, like the music of a different generation, or did she sound like yours?
Absolutely not. She's a very contemporary to me because it's about the feelings. It's about the human condition. It's almost la condition humaine, as we say in French. It's timeless, and it's so human that you cannot put a date on it. Although she makes reference, like Mon Légionnaire, to certain periods, it's still very profound, and it truly is timeless. And yes, it is a Billie Holiday equivalent, I believe. It's just very, very intimate, and it will never cease to be. And I do hope my daughter sees the joy I get when I listen to it.
And you've already put her feet on the path with La Vie en Rose lyrics for her. Thierry, thanks for calling. Olivier Dahan, it must be intimidating to pick up such an enormous French figure as this and convey her to the French and the world. You said you were looking to communicate what drove her as an artist. What did you find there? How would you define what drove Edith Piaf?
I didn't find it, actually, but I've tried to find it out, but no. But I was not impressed at the very beginning because I was not a fan at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a photo that gave me my first impulsion to make this movie. It's not like a... Strangely, it is not a song or music or voice. It was a photo. And I never consider Piaf as an icon. She's an artist, and she's still an artist. I mean, and when people say in French, she's an icon, you have to do, you have to be very careful when you're going to do the movie and everything. Of course, I will be careful, but she's not an icon for me. She's just an artist. It's quite big.
Just a quite big artist. You saw a photo of her as a very young woman, and it piqued your interest. She got picked up into the nightclub scene by the character played by Gérard Depardieu, Louis Leplay, and made her name there. Very popular in the French nightclub scene. Then he was murdered, and she was fingered potentially as an accomplice to that murder. Why? Some link to the mob or the mafia in Paris?
She was not like linked, but she knew at this time she was living in Belleville, and in Belleville there was a lot of mob and a lot of little thieves and, you know, this kind of people. So she was just living around with them, so they knew each other, everyone, and so there is no like the, but she was not really involved in the murder. She has been accused, but she was very, very quick released of this.
But it was hard life she was living next to, and quite a scene. She gets picked up from there and soon gets into the recording end of the music business. And, well, it doesn't take long before the whole world knows about Edith Piaf. When we come back, we'll look at her time in the United States, at the great love of her life. Olivier Dahan is with us. He's director and screenwriter of La Vie en Rose. It opens in the United States on June 8th. David Loosely is with us from Leeds, University of Leeds, and Jean-Max Guy from Georgetown University as well. You can join us. Do they make singers like this anymore? And what was it, what is it about this woman that made her voice so compelling? Edith Piaf. 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Au fond de moi, mais soudain je pousse un cri parmi les rires quand la foule vient l'arracher d'entre mes bras, emportée par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, nous éloigne l'un de l'autre. Je lutte et je me débat, mais le son de ma voix s'étouffe dans le rire des autres, et je crie de douleur, de fureur et de rage, et je pleure. Et traînée par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, je suis emportée.
chanter au loin. Et je crispe mes poings maudissant la foule qui me vole, l'homme qu'elle m'avait donné que je n'ai jamais retrouvé.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress at Rite Aid GNC and Duane Reade, and RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles, 617-859-0540.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the life and music of Edith Piaf, the famed French singer, whose story is told in the new movie, La Vie en Rose.
Mon Dieu, mon Dieu, mon Dieu, laissez-le-moi.
Edith Piaf sings there about Mon Dieu, her God, in her 1961 song. The director of the new film, La Vie en Rose, Olivier Dahan, is with us. Jean-Max Gu joins us from Washington, and from Leeds in England, David Loosely is here. You can join the conversation. Is this still the sound of the French heart, the soul of France, or is Piaf an icon from a bygone time? How do you hear her? 800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-8255. Talk. She came into the world of recording, performing in the big concert halls in Paris, and then, of course, taken right around the world. She says, Olivier Dahan, in your movie, she says, I couldn't care less about America. I don't get them, and they don't get me. But she was on Ed Sullivan 8 times and played in Carnegie Hall, so something was going on there.
No, but she said that at the very beginning, at the very, very beginning, because she was, like, so impatient. That at the very beginning, for the response of the Americans wasn't what she was really expected.
She said, "Americans want beauties, not me."
Yeah,
yeah.
She wasn't so pretty actually. Yes,
but they found out they wanted her. We've got a little tape here from another film with a reference to Edith Piaf, Steven Spielberg's 1998 Academy Award-winning Saving Private Ryan. Here, just to give a sense, here's the troops out in the field in that film finding Edith Piaf on a fuzzy radio station after D-Day. Here, an American trooper translates Edith Piaf's song from French into English.
And you say things that make my eyes close. And I find that marvelous.
Again, Papa Ma, yes. To be honest with you, I find myself curiously aroused by you and
marvelous. No, it's a, you know, it's a really melancholy song. At the beginning of the song, she says, "And then one day you left me, and I've been desperate ever since. I see you all over the sky. I see you all over the earth."
Jesus, for many more songs like this, the crowds aren't going to have to shoot me. I'm just going to slip my own wrist.
You're a strange bird of them.
Many more songs like this, the crowds won't have to shoot me. I'll slit my wrist. Jean-Max Gu, what about the American response to this singer? 8 times on Ed Sullivan, that's not so bad.
Well, I think we had is someone who was so much of a Parisian, used to the type of audience she will relate to. And then she arrived in New York and would sing at the Versailles, for instance, which is a big, huge nightclub.
Yeah.
And it's true, she was not projecting herself like Marlene Dietrich that you see in the movie, for instance, because she was not singing in a beautiful evening dress with diamonds everywhere. She will wear this little dress, you know. And I remember you were asking me about souvenirs. I remember remember my mother had seen Edith Piaf in Marseille one day. She was crossing from the music hall to the hotel, and she said, my God, she was dressed so badly, and her shoes, she must have found them at the Goodwill, something like that.
Like a vagabond.
And it's true, she was not beautiful at all. I mean, she had a very mournful face, she had bad teeth, she had bad posture, and suddenly she would become something else on the stage. And that was part of what she was doing in France. And she realized at first in New York that she was surrounded with people in tuxedos and long dress, and she didn't feel at ease. But then slowly she started liking Americans. She has a few songs which are American songs, for instance, of the time. And she returned regularly to America. That, in a way, made her not a French singer, but an international singer for the French. And this is when, I guess, she became more than just the person who was at the beginning singing songs by which had been sang before by Marie Dubas, like the Légionnaire, or the song she sings in the movie Comme un moineau, like a sparrow, which was a song that other artists had sang before. And she moved on, and then she started having, in a way, people will write lyrics for her, music for her, exactly to her character, or the character she wanted to project.
Let's hear from those listeners who heard her then. Ron's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Ron, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have to laugh at myself because I'm in my late 60s, and I don't know if there's anyone who makes my heart pound as much as Edith, and I'm almost out of breath here. I can hardly talk.
Oh, my goodness. That's the real thing. What is it about her?
I'm an American, and I got her when I was 10 years old. I had been raised on Roy Rogers and the Three Stooges, and at 10 years old, watching the Ed Sullivan Show, here is Edith Piaf, and my heart started to pound. And I mean, I never understood at that time, but I know now that it was the raw emotion, it was the humanity. I was raised in a culture that was based on appearances. Mm-hmm. If it looks okay, it is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And here is Edith Piaf. I couldn't understand the words, but I could hear her saying, everything isn't okay. Life is hard and life hurts. And I knew that inside, but I didn't have any way to express it. And Edith was expressing it for me. Later on, in 1959 to 1962, I was in the U.S. Army in Germany, and they had Edith Piaf on the jukebox, and I would play her songs and drink beer all night. And when I walked in the restaurant, the manager would say, ah, hello, Edith Piaf.
Right, let's roll it, let's spin it. Oh, Ron, you put it beautifully. You really do. But the melancholy that we heard the trooper in Spielberg's film saying, you know, I'm going to slit my wrist, to you, it opened up a world of you.
Oh, it, well, it didn't open. It opened up the emotional part of life, which I had no exposure to because it wasn't allowed, you know. I wasn't allowed access to it.
Yeah, American ears open to Edith. Ron, thank you so much for that. David Loosley in the UK, what about to a British audience? Was this seen as a doorway into a richer, more romantic realm of emotion, a French realm of emotion, or as an international singer?
I think certainly you're right. I think that it's very interesting what your callers are saying and how some words keep coming back in what they're saying. Ron was just talking about his heart pounding, and a couple of the ones earlier were talking about the humanity that you hear in Piaf. And I think probably that's exactly how she was heard over here. I think the thing that really strikes me about the importance of this of Piaf is trying to get some sense of that voice. And I think really what it is that the voice is a popular voice. It's a people's voice in the sense that it's not a perfect voice. You know, it's not a musically perfect voice. But it is, as some of your callers were saying, it's incredibly human. and it has an imperfection about it that makes it human. And I was thinking about what you were talking about, you know, how she took a while to take off in the States, and she herself said at one point that she wanted to make people cry, even if they didn't understand the words that she was singing about. And there again, you see, I think that comes back to that question of the voice, which does, as Ron was just saying, it does communicate something, even if you haven't got a clue what she's saying.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, absolutely. I think the appeal that she had in the States is the same appeal that she had over here in Britain. I think it's to do with a kind of frailness and humanity that comes over, irrespective of the lyrics.
Mm. And tremendous beauty coming right in behind it. I mean, I was opened up to Edith Piaf by a French father-in-law who always sang and whistled Piaf. And what a great doorway opened with that. Let's take a call from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to say that I have a very evocative memory of hearing and seeing Edith Piaf perform at the Hotel de Ville when I was there. I believe it was 1962.
Oh, my goodness. And what were you doing there? How old were you?
I was 21, and I had just graduated from college, and I decided to flee to France. But it was interesting because, for me, this was just magic. I mean, this was the embodiment of all that was French, and it was so, everything that I was there for when I heard her. But my friends I was sort of part of a French group of artists, young artists, and they were very pseudo-sophisticated. And to them, Edith Piaf represented the past. But I mean, and I wanted to also say that she was referred to as the little sparrow. And when you saw her hands were just so, they were almost like little wings. I mean, they were so evocative. They would just move and flutter.
Those beautiful hands, and very much put to work. Olivier Dahan, you have a kind of coached Edith, telling her, use your hands, they're beautiful, and her responding dutifully here. Olivier?
Yes, sorry.
She made her hands very deliberately part of her performance.
Yeah, from the very beginning, she was, Raymond Asso was her first mentor. I don't know how to say that. He was the first that gave her the presence on stage, and also he was the first to make a very how do you say that in English? Un tour de chant complet, a complete
recital.
A
kind of complete recital for her.
A recital. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it teach her how to really being and behave on a stage. Yes, in a very early, she was 20 something like this at this time.
And it never stopped the rest of her life. You take her right to very near the end when songwriters.
I think she was a good student.
Yeah, well, as you portray it, she didn't have much choice. He was a fierce mentor, but she certainly picked it up.
Yeah, but she was really a good student, and she wanted, during all her life, she was like a fan of culture, and she read after that a lot, and you know, she was, she didn't want to stay just like out of the street.
Mm. I want to go to the point much later in her life when, as often happened, young songwriters would come to her, play something on the piano, you have her listening for a few bars and knowing within just seconds whether it was for her or not. When the young man comes and plays for her her 1960 song, No Regrets, she knows right away that this is a song, despite her declining health, that she needs to sing, to own. Let's listen.
Le bien qu'on m'a fait, ni le mal, tout ça m'est bien égal. Non, rien de rien, non, je ne regrette rien, c'est payé.
Edith Piaf with No Regrets. Jean-Max Gu, I mean, the message is right there in the title. And yet, how do you explain it? She says, to hell with the past. I'll have no regrets. I've forgotten the past. What, because the past, her past was too difficult to remember? Or is she lying? Is the past really all she lives for in her nostalgia and romance?
Oh, no. The song is saying that, in a way, it's part of the pathetic of Piaf. Mm. It's now with you, my new love, I can start all over again. I forget the past. The past is erased now with you. I have no regret for my past. And now with all my souvenirs, I can forget them and move on. And of course, you have this sort of feeling that you have at the end of Traviata, of the character saying, I'm going to live again. Mm. And you know that, of course, she won't make it again. And this is more or less what you have in all her songs, and especially at the end. So she has no regrets, as in English, but I don't regret anything now because with you, I can start all over again.
Mm-hmm. David Lusley, this must have been, in many ways, a message that Europe needed in 1961. It had been a tough, tough century that she sang of.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that was, I mean, I came across that song when I was still a teenager. It was in my older sister's record collection, and she knew French long before I did. And even then, at the age of whatever I was, 14 or something like that, I was aware that there was something very kind of uplifting in that song, which I think is what makes it one of her really great songs. As Jean-Max was just saying, the element that really makes it a good song is that there's a constant sort of play between the optimism and the tragedy, because, as he says, the song is not just saying, it's not just Frank Sinatra's My Way, you know, it's not just saying, I'm old and I'm looking back over my life and I did it my way. It's saying that all of that now is behind me because I have a new love, which in fact turned out to be true in her life. She did have a new young husband at that point.
Yes.
But of course, as we know, only a couple of years after she said that, she died. Yeah. So there's this constant oscillation between the tragedy of her situation and the optimism, the irrepressible optimism that comes over in the song. I think it's a great song.
Of cancer at 47. Olivier Dahan, you say you look at her not as an icon but an artist. After making the film, what does she inspire you to as an artist, Edith Piaf? How does she change you?
I don't know if she really changed me, but she, I'm a little bit like maybe, I don't know, I'm not pretentious at all, but a little bit like the people that she take care of when she was, like, for example, taking care of Yves Montand. And I mean, it's a little bit like this, because I have the impression now that she just gave me a new step, I mean, for me.
Yeah. Well, it's some film. Olivier Dahan, the film is La Vie en Rose. It brings back the life of Edith Piaf. Thanks for being with us. And Jean-Max Gueux at Georgetown University, David Lusley at University of Leeds, thank you so much to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.